Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. The Office of the State Budget Director in Frankfort says the impact of COVID-19 on state tax collections will be profound. There has been a rapid erosion of the tax dollars it takes to fund all sorts of public services, including the vital ones. And two new federal laws begin to address this new and unexpected strain on state government, but are they enough? Or will the economic turndown that is now expected require something more aggressive from Washington? Jason Bailey is here to help us calibrate our expectations. Jason is founder and executive director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Nice to be here.
And Jason, I'd like to ask you to help us comprehend the scope and scale of what we're facing. There are new forecasts that tell us that the economic loss from the COVID-19 crisis will likely be worse than the lowest point in the Great Recession. Are we able at this point to get a handle on what's at stake and what that looks like for Kentucky?
Well, we know that each of the forecasts that have come out have made the picture even worse in terms of what we're likely looking at. Essentially, large parts of the economy have shut down. You know, entire sectors are closed. Spending has been cut back dramatically by consumers as they've either lost their jobs or are limited in their activities, their travel, their shopping, and so forth. And so we know it's going to be big. We know that already in Kentucky, 280,000 people have filed unemployment claims, and many thousands more are in the queue to do so. And, you know, that just has a huge effect on sales tax receipts, on the income tax receipts that we collect as a state. And we also don't know how long this is going to last. That's the other issue, is that we know that the unemployment rate is going to shoot very high. And we also don't know how long we'll be dealing with high unemployment. And so that makes it doubly concerning for the outlook for state budgets and local budgets.
How does what we're facing right now compare with what happened during the Great Recession?
Well, the forecasts now are that likely the unemployment rate will be much higher than it was at the worst point in the Great Recession. Here in Kentucky, the unemployment rate hit 10%, was the worst point. You know, we're looking at possibly an unemployment rate of 15 to 20% by the summer in Kentucky, just to give you one example of what we're looking at. So, you know, this is different than the Great Recession. That was a financial crisis, a housing crisis that then sort of rippled through. This is a sort of a forced shutdown for public health reasons to save lives and protect health. And, you know, that just has a different type of effect. But essentially, we've intentionally, you know, caused the closure of businesses and the unemployment of people to limit the spread of the virus. But in some ways, you know, that has an even bigger impact on job loss, therefore on tax receipts for government.
Okay, for anybody that doesn't understand this, if you could just briefly tell us how the state raises the money it takes to pay for all of those public services that it provides.
Sure. Kentucky has a pretty wide range of tax sources, but there's two big ones. About 77% of revenue come from the individual income tax that people pay once a year and is withheld from their paycheck, as well as the sales tax you pay when you purchase goods and services. So those are the two big ones. And that makes, you know, this type of recession from COVID-19 particularly harmful to revenues, because when people aren't working anymore, then there's not income taxes being withheld from their check. And when businesses are closed or people are spending less because they've lost their jobs or they can't go out, that hurts sales tax receipts. So the two big sources are really the two areas where we expect to see some of the largest hits in terms of revenue. And that's what makes the state budget really vulnerable at this time.
And the Commerce Department is telling us that retail sales were down 8.7% in March. I think it's the largest monthly decline ever.
Right. And that didn't even, you know, that doesn't take into account a full month of reduced sales, mm-hmm. because many businesses weren't shutting down until toward the end of March. So in April, we're going to see an even worse fall. I mean, this is really unprecedented, where we're essentially closing large parts of the economy, and for good reason. But it's also to be expected that the economic hit will be very hard.
Jason, did our state legislature in the session that adjourned last week do anything to increase revenues that might help with this?
No, they didn't. They ended up passing, they always pass a revenue bill. This one only will raise about $5 million, which is really a rounding error in the state budget. They didn't seriously consider raising additional revenues throughout. There was some discussion about a few different options. None of those generated a whole lot of money, but none of them got out of the starting box. That's one of the reasons that we're not very well prepared for this COVID-19 downturn. We didn't generate new money. And that's different from during the Great Recession. We didn't do a comprehensive overhaul of the tax system back then, but we at least raised tobacco taxes and alcohol taxes to raise about $150 million to cushion the blow from the Great Recession. We didn't do that this time. And it's one of the reasons that, I think we should be very concerned about where the budget is headed.
And in addition to what you just said, what about those tax cuts in 2018, 2019 for banks and corporations? Aren't they just now being phased in, and won't that take an additional slice out of the pie?
Absolutely. The state is, in two consecutive years during the legislative session, they enacted major tax changes and tax cuts. They eliminated the tax on banks that we had. A number of the corporate tax cuts that they passed also are a hit to the budget. And then they reduced the top income tax rate for wealthy individuals. So all those things are kind of being phased in. And so we were already seeing the worst revenue forecast we had in 25 years of revenue forecasting, even before this happened. So that put us in a really bad position already. And again, it will be much worse when the full hit comes from the recession.
Does the state's balanced budget requirement limit its flexibility to make it through, to manage this kind of situation?
It does, because when recessions hit like this, not only do revenues go down, but costs go up. So things like, obviously, we're dealing directly with COVID-19, that's state dollars that are going into the public health departments, into the National Guard that's come in to help with certain things, all the purchase of supplies like the PPE and ventilators, and that's all coming out of state dollars. In addition to that, the Medicaid program, which is a large part of the state budget, a lot more people become eligible for Medicaid when they lose their jobs or lose income. And so those roles grow. Also, it's the case that, a lot of people who are covered under Medicaid are those who may be at risk or need treatment for COVID-19. Now, you think about the people in nursing homes. Many of the people in nursing homes are covered by Medicaid. Those are also state costs that will go up. So states are not able to handle or counteract recessions themselves because they have balanced budget requirements. Their costs go up and their revenues go down. And that's really where the federal government has to step in a big way to really counteract that effect and make sure the dollars are there to both address the current crisis and also keep state governments from pulling the economy down further through budget cuts.
Okay, let's talk about that. As we said, Congress passed a pair of initial stimulus bills, but we don't know how long business closures and other social distancing requirements will be in effect. It could be a while. By most accounts, that legislation won't come close to offsetting the losses that we can now expect. So what else could Congress do to help soften the blow for a state like Kentucky?
Well, Congress can pass more aid to states, and they absolutely need to do that because, as you say, the amounts that were provided in the first couple of stimulus bills are not nearly what's needed now that we more deeply understand the scale of the downturn that we're facing. So they can come back and put additional money in. They can do it by increasing the match for Medicaid, which again is an important cost that goes up. The federal government can pick up more of that cost. They can also provide flexible grants that allow states to deal with the cost that they face and plug holes in their budget. And they can provide aid that continues until the economy is in full recovery. The problem with the aid that is provided so far, it's just it will expire and it will, we will run out. But we don't know, as you say, we don't know how long this will last. And even when the restrictions are lifted, you know, there's still going to be things that will probably limit the growth of the economy. If you think about people who deferred debt during this time, if you think about certain businesses that may not be able to reopen at all, those things and more can also sort of limit how strong the economy will come back. So we need to have aid that is automatically triggered to continue until we get the unemployment rate back to at least where it was before all this hit. And those sort of mechanisms are not in place. Now, thankfully, there is a conversation in Washington about a next round, but it's not at all clear what will be in there and whether aid to state governments will be in there and whether, if it is in there, it will be adequate to really deal with the problem that we're facing.
Well, let's say that Congress does come through with more aid for Kentucky. We don't know what it would look like yet, but let's say they do. What then? Our legislature just ended its 2020 session. Will allocation of those funds require legislative action? Would this maybe require a special session, which is costly in itself?
Well, there are rules in place and laws in place and procedures in the budget that allow the governor to receive and spend federal funds. And so he should have broad authority to do that. There may be debate about that down the road and about the legal authority for him to do so. But he should be able to do that. If we're having to deal with budget cuts that are very large because there's not enough federal aid, I think that's where the governor's authority is limited at some point. And he will have to call the legislature back in a special session to decide how to make those cuts. I hope we don't get there. Again, we need to have enough federal aid. And you know, we have extremely important members of Congress, not the least of which is the majority leader in the Senate, who are very influential in whether or not we get enough aid. So Kentucky is well positioned to make this happen. We just need to make sure that it happens. Otherwise, we'll be back to what happened during the Great Recession, which is that we received about $3 billion. But it wasn't enough. It ran out when the unemployment rate was still about 10%, and it really hampered the recovery for the remainder of that decade. And we don't want to be back in that situation where state budget cuts and reduced state spending is a drag on the recovery. We want to make sure that the state is contributing to the overall growth and reopening of the economy once we get to that point.
Jason Bailey, Executive Director of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, and we thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update. Hosted by Kelly McEvers, NPR's Coronavirus Daily podcast is available at weku.org. You can look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest stories. The program is available wherever you listen to podcasts and at weku.org. Coming up after the break, Silas House.
I just wish more people would acknowledge that climate change is a real thing.
Carla Gover.
Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be here with our first segment of the Kentucky Song Crafters series.
And newly minted Kentucky author Bobby Kahn.
We collectively need to experience more empathy and to have more compassion.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
It's been a very wet winter in eastern Kentucky. Enough rain to saturate the ground, the overflow of rivers and streams sending floodwaters into scores of homes and businesses. The event came and went with little notice outside of the immediate region. That is until Kentucky writer Silas House captured the moment in an article for The Atlantic, and he's here to talk about it. Greetings, Silas.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
And what I thought I'd do here is just read excerpts from your essay and ask you to elaborate on them. So I'm beginning with this. I bet most Americans have no idea this natural disaster has been happening. When trouble comes to rural people, whether they're in Kentucky, California, Montana, or Michigan, the media mostly shrug. The public as a whole is no better, as people seem to have little sympathy for these rural areas. I've been asked, why do people live there anyway? These sentiments aren't directed only at Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, for one thing, in my piece for The Atlantic, I wanted to make it clear that while I'm talking about Appalachia, that I think that this is about rural people, period. You know, and no matter where I go in the United States, the people who are rural voice this complaint. I mean, I've just heard it over and over. In fact, when the essay came out, some of the comments were really disgusting. I mean, and, you know, you're taught not to read the comments, but sometimes, you know, people fill your email and you have to read some of them. I was told that people here deserve to drown because of their politics. I was told that they get what they deserve for living here. A few years ago, millions of people in West Virginia had their water poisoned, and the national response tended toward the same thing. Whether people realize it or not, that reaction is rampant because they see Appalachia as a place of poverty, I think, is the main reason. Now, they're not as quick to say these things about a place like Flint, Michigan. They do say that, but they're not as quick to say it openly about a place like Flint, Michigan, where the water is also poison, because they know that people will call them out on the racism in that case. But I think that people are quicker to do this about rural areas because they have this misconception that everybody in a rural area is white, for one thing, and they feel safer in their classism, I think, in voicing that. So I think what it comes down to is it's always okay to negate poor people and powerless people. And I think that's what happens again and again, to, you know, question why somebody wants to live in a particular place.
I think you're beginning to identify a lot of aspects to this. One of them that you point out is an out-of-sight, out-of-mind mentality that can take hold when people lose their connection to nature.
Yeah. And another thing that I tried to point out in the essay is that I'm not putting forth that only rural people care about nature or the environment. I know that's not true. However, I do think that the natural world plays a bigger part in the everyday life of rural people. I mean, if you think about the power centers, meaning the media centers of this country, like New York City or Los Angeles, the places that set the tone for national conversations, in those places, people tend to experience or visit nature in more structured environments. They're not living within nature as much as rural people are. In a rural place, the land and the bodies of water dictate where you build your house, how long it's going to take you to get somewhere based on how far down the river you have to go to cross it to find a bridge, or how long it's going to take you to get around the mountain. So, I mean, nature is more a part of everyday life, I think. And to some degree, a lot of these rural places are more agricultural and so depend more on the natural world in lots of ways. And I don't know, it matters when you have your hands in the dirt more. You're more conscious of the dirt, you know. I know that when I was a child, I had this incredible ridge in front of our house where we spent all of our time. We played in the creek there. We rode sleds there in the wintertime. You know, it was just our paradise as children. And then one day I got up and there were four bulldozers sitting there. And over the next 2 years, that ridge was destroyed. And that really changed my whole conception of how nature could be taken from you so easily and tamed by machines, you know. And so I think that when you live in an extractive place, you're more aware of that too.
Americans claim to love the natural world, but we often negate the people who live closest to it. That's another excerpt from the essay. And again, it goes to that attitude toward rural people.
Well, I think that it just goes back to this idea that rural people are throwaway people, this idea that people who live in flyover country or middle America or, you know, the middle of nowhere, those phrases are just thrown around all the time, and what they imply is an inferiority. Yet, you know, the Great Smoky Mountain National Park is the most visited national park in the United States. But when tourists go there, one of the things that they love to buy are hillbilly kitsch, you know, whatnots of outhouses and people in floppy straw hats and corncob pipes and things like that. You see that in all the, well, not all of them, but a lot of the gift shops down in the Smoky Mountains. It doesn't make sense, them laughing and buying those sorts of things, thinking that that's clever or, you know, something to make light of, while they're in that place to experience nature, I mean, is a contradiction in itself, you know. So I do think it happens all the time. I also think that historically, America has always thought of Appalachia as the worst of the country, but also the best of the country. And both of those stereotypes are dangerous. You know, there's this idea, people say to me all the time when I'm on book tour, they'll say, oh, things must move so slowly where you're from. Things must be so simple. And they mean that with a positive connotation, but the way it strikes me is saying that our lives are not as complicated or as, you know, harried as theirs are. You know, but they have this sort of Mayberry mentality about rural America that's just not true, that that implies that our lives aren't complex.
Is there maybe a more complex, complicated place in the United States than Appalachia?
I can't think of one. I mean, that's why I've written 6 novels about it. You know, I mean, it's so complicated that I can't boil it down to a soundbite. I have to write a book about it.
You begin the article by recounting what happened to you in a flood that struck Lilly, your hometown.
Right.
For the sake of our listeners who might not have read the article yet, so that they can understand where you're coming from here, tell us a little bit about that incident.
Well, when I was 2 years old, my family was a really young family, and we lived in a small trailer, little mobile home, and it was situated between a creek and the railroad. And, you know, the railroad is almost always raised, and so we were sort of trapped when that creek rose. And it had rained for several days, but the flood sort of came all at once. It was a flash flood. And my mother saw the water rising and had to wade in waist-high icy water in early March, water full of debris and sewage and everything else, you know, to get us both out of there. By the time my father got home, the water was up to the windows, and they lost just about everything they had. You know, the trailer was pretty much destroyed. Their appliances were destroyed, their furnace, etc. And so that left, you know, an indelible mark on my family for the rest of our lives. We knew what it was like to lose everything. And when you are in the middle of a natural disaster like that, the last thing you need is the response of people saying you deserve that because of where you're from. I mean, it's the most heartless reaction I can think of.
And when you saw these images of the recent flooding, the recent flash flooding that hit the area, I'm taking it that it took you right back to those moments?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and even though my family moved to higher land after that, we still experienced flooding, you know, all throughout my childhood. It was something that happened. Having said that, it is different now, I think, that when the flooding happens, I think it's much bigger, a much bigger scope, And I mean, the weather has changed. When it rains a lot more in a short time. And I mean, all that's been proven statistically. And so I think that, you know, when we talk about climate change, for example, Appalachia is going to be one of the places that's impacted by that because it's already starting to happen. And of course, we know that the people who will be most impacted by climate change are people in poorer areas, you know, with less development and things like that.
You close your wonderful essay with this line: "We had to be like my mother all those years ago, facing the icy floodwaters. We must take a deep breath and then take the first step." Mm-hmm. What, in your view, is that first step?
Well, there are many, but that I would like for people to take. But I think the major one is I just wish more people would acknowledge that climate change is a real thing and that it's something that we can fight. I mean, there is this notion that it's too late. And at least where I'm from and the part of Appalachia I'm from, it is a very fatalistic place. There's this idea that things are the way they are and you might as well accept them. There's also this idea that, well, you know, the Lord's coming back, and so there's no use in trying to change the environment or anything like that. And I just think that we have a responsibility to our children and our grandchildren, to future generations, to try to do the best we can, no matter what you can do. I mean, it's as simple as not leaving the lights burning all day long, or, you know, not wasting water, et cetera, et cetera. There are lots of ways to impact change, and I think we can all do that.
A video by Ben Childers that accompanied your article about the recent flooding in eastern Kentucky has been posted to our website. That's on esweku.org. Kentucky-based writer Silas House, thank you so much, Silas.
Thank you, Tom.
Now, with an addition to our lineup of series here on Eastern Standard, singer-songwriter Carla Gover.
Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be here with our first segment of the Kentucky Songcrafters series. The Kentucky Songcrafters is a group of songwriters that I sort of assembled. I called up everybody and asked if they wanted to join a group whose purpose would be to further our own work, maybe make some new fans, to offer our songs to be recorded and covered by national artists, and also to place our music in films and soundtracks and television. And I just wanted to do something like this as a way of helping other Kentucky songwriters, but also of introducing the world to some of the amazing, but perhaps a little bit lesser known, songwriters from here in our state, because Kentucky is full of songwriting talent. Joining us for our first segment is someone that I personally collaborate with artistically, and we have a band together, actually, and a couple of very talented daughters together. But he's an amazingly talented songwriter from Berea, Kentucky, and that is Mitch Barrett. He's on the line with us today. Hey, Mitch.
Hey, how you doing?
Hanging in there, man.
Yeah.
It's an intense time for songwriters right now because we've just lost our shining beacon.
Yeah, we lost our mentor.
I think every songwriter in Kentucky reveres John Prine, safe to say.
Yeah, I like to think we didn't lose him, because that's the beauty of this songwriting thing. Is, you know, I think Darryl Scott said it best. You know, every song John Prine ever wrote, he's present in that song. Even when somebody else sings it, you hear John Prine. So he's not gone. He just don't live here anymore.
Yeah. What is your opinion about why Kentucky produces so many great songwriters? What is it about the state or the culture?
I think it is the culture. We come from folks who are still kind of rooted in their culture. I mean, I remember I've been working in schools for years, and I remember part of something I used to say, and I probably read it somewhere or heard it, but we're one of the last groups of people that our culture is still intact. And I always used to tell fifth graders, it's up to you whether or not that will continue. You get to choose to either throw these old things away or hold on to them like our culture has done for so long. I think it is our culture. And, you know, back a few years ago, the whole Texas thing where we had Towns Van Zandt and Guy Clark and Steve Earle and all these people coming out of Texas. I think that was cultural too. You know, it was very agrarian people coming from a culture that was still alive, and people started to notice it. You know, Mr. Pride himself, one time when I met him, said, "People aren't buying the truth right now." And this was 35, 40 years ago when I met John in Lexington one time. He said, "People aren't buying the truth right now, but it will come back around." I really think it has a lot to do with it.
Well, I know that for you personally, that has a lot to do with your songwriting. And another guest on this segment, Bobby Kahn, whose book In the Shadow of the Valley is just coming out. A couple songs from our band, Zoe Speaks, are featured on the playlist that she created for that book. And one of them is a track of Mitch singing Amazing Grace in a very traditional style. So would you like to tell us, Mitch, a little bit about how the music you grew up with influenced your songwriting? And also, if you want to just expand on that a little bit and tell us about your songwriting journey in general, I think that would be interesting.
My grandmother, I always go back to my grandmother. She encouraged us to read, not just read. She didn't press it on us, but it was there. It was present. She wanted us to read Kentucky authors, and she wanted us to be proud of being from Kentucky. And I don't know if my granny ever thought of herself as Appalachian as much as she thought of herself as Kentuckian, but she wanted us to be prepared for the world outside that was going to stereotype us as backwards, ignorant people. And so she shared some of the great Kentucky writers, and that influenced my writing. And my grandmother just had a big influence. You know, I mean, she only had a high school education, but she knew that getting things out of you was very important. And the people around me were storytellers. You know, I give Granny credit, but my pa and my poppy and my grandma on the other side of my family, and then just neighbors, just some of these characters around my neighborhood. There was an old fella named Tick. My grandfather called him Tick, but his real name was Marshall Lee. But, you know, Marshall Lee sat up on his little hill and cast with a rod and reel down into the neighbor's chicken pen and catching the chicken. You know, he'd have a can of corn and catch the chicken. You can't make that stuff
so
up.
So he was fishing for chickens.
He was fishing for chicken. And you can't make that stuff up. It was good. It was good. And I saw that. And I think it colored how I write and how I think about people and characters.
Well, anybody that listens to your music knows that you put a lot of those family stories in your songs. You actually talk about the work that you and your family have done. So your community has definitely influenced you, but also we know that you have spent a lot of time working in various communities throughout Kentucky with institutionalized incarcerated people, with children, with at-risk populations. How do you feel like you've used songwriting as a tool to interact with those people?
Well, I'd love to say I was a Mother Teresa or something, but I'm not. It came to me through just survival, but I didn't want to play bars. And I had played some schools and just kind of discovered through my own healing work, and I'll call it that proudly, because it's very healing for me to write a song. And when I go through something, even as a young boy, when I go through something and my grandmother encouraging me to get it out of me, that's where I discovered it. It's very healing. And then to stumble upon it again as an adult, I realized, whoa, this is something I could do. And I feel proud to do it because I know it works. So I'm not lying. I'm not feeding them something I read. I know this works. I know that being creative is very healing. And I've seen it work. Over the past 25 years, I've seen it work very well with children, teenagers, and adults. Sexually abused, physically abused, addiction, all of that. And, you know, we're all broken. And I've just discovered that when you realize you're not the only one broken, then there is community, you know. And that's what I base my workshops on and everything, is just helping these folks, because you'd be surprised how many people who are actually locked up together think they're the only person going through what they're going through. And then to watch them discover the 15 people in the room with them have something in common, and it's not just drugs and it's not just abuse. There's a lot in common there, and that's just a beautiful thing to watch. And when I discovered that, I pretty much dedicated my life to doing it.
What is your hope and your dream, or what would be your best case scenario for your songs and for your music in the world? What would you like to see?
Well, you know, like all songwriters, singers, performers, I used to have that dream of getting famous, but that has changed so much over the years, and not just because I'm getting older, but because it has changed. And I really see a clear focus now of like I was saying, I would love for my music to just touch people. And if somebody got something from that, and I will keep trying to write real songs and honest songs. That's what I see for the future. I don't know career-wise or anything like that. I know that I will keep doing this as long as I'm sucking air. I'm going to be making up songs and stories and sharing old stories with kids. And I just love it. And I think it's very important, especially in our world today. And I think more and more, of course, we're all going through that now. You know, the upside of this this virus thing is you're just seeing so many people in their yards. And you know, I drove through Red Lick the other day and I saw at least 6 fires at sunset. 6 fires with people in their yard, with their families around these fires, and people in their gardens. And so I don't know. I can quote Doc Watson, who said, that old stuff has been around a long time for a reason. They don't call it traditional for no reason. I mean, it is good, and there's meaning there, and there's substance there. And I think if we keep reaching for that and creating our own new traditions, you know.
Amen. Well, I couldn't agree more, and I know that you do teach and reach people with your music, and you touch hearts. We appreciate that, and we're going to keep working together in the Kentucky Songcrafters to spread the great work that Kentucky musicians are doing here to bigger audiences if possible, and to keep touching hearts and minds and creating positivity in the world. So thanks for being here with us today, Mitch.
Thank you, Carla, for the Kentucky Songcrafters. I would love to see what happened in Texas happen in Kentucky, because there's so much talent here and everybody knows it.
Like me, I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see.
Bobby Kahn loves playing pool, telling jokes, cooking, being in the woods, gardening, and spending time with her kids. May sound idyllic, but in the background there lurks a childhood of violence, poverty, a lot of drugs, and self-loathing. Bobby has synthesized these life experiences, worked them into a narrative, and is about to publish In the Shadow of the Valley, her debut memoir, scheduled for release on May 1st. Bobby joins us by phone from Edgewood, Kentucky. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Tom.
Where exactly was home for you?
We had a holler in Clearfield, Kentucky, basically just a tiny town adjacent to Moorhead.
Let's turn to the book. I'd like to read a passage from a review on KirkusReviews.com and then ask you to comment. It says, Kahn grew up in a Kentucky holler in the 1980s. As a child, she endured a life marked by poverty and abuse, both of which were common in the region. Her father was an alcoholic drug dealer who often beat her and her mother and brother. In order to survive, she silently endured the pain as her distrust for others grew. And soon, Kahn fell into her own cycle of drug abuse, as well as physical and sexual abuse from her circle of companions. Does that accurately establish the theme for your book?
I'd say that well captures the story, basically. Although I hope that other themes emerge for the reader, including the history of Appalachia, the significance of Appalachian culture And then also the beauty of storytelling, and particularly the oral traditions that are common in cultures like the Appalachian culture.
You describe your childhood home as a place of tranquility, natural beauty, tin-roofed house in a forest, sparkling creek with frogs and crawdads, blackberries growing along the road to your grandmother's home. It sounds wonderful, but the life you were living in the midst of all that beauty was, in fact, quite the opposite. Is that correct?
Yes, definitely.
And you had to relive a lot of these painful memories in order to capture them for the pages of this book. What sort of process did you use to pull together the details of your life, the things that happened to you, organize it all into a narrative that then resulted in this book, all while looking out for your well-being?
Well, I began the book as my creative writing thesis when I was getting my master's at Eastern Kentucky University. And really, I just wanted to start by telling this story about my father sending me down to his mother's house, my granny's house, to call her an awful name. And as I was writing this story, as is so common, I think, with Appalachian storytellers, there were so many other intersecting stories that I felt also had to be told to provide context and to flesh out the characters and the significance of this one moment. So I really began writing it stream of consciousness. And I came to a point where it made sense to end that story. Later, I went and added a lot more material, including more of my young adult life and going into my 30s a little bit. It was honestly, from my perspective, difficult to organize it all. And I think that having an agent and then an editor look at it from an objective perspective was just enormously beneficial. And as far as taking care of myself during all of this, that I think is probably the most difficult thing for me to really put my finger on. You know, I realize that I'm very, very lucky to be able to tell my story. And at this point, I'm lucky to have an audience. It gives me a sense of strength to know that I survived certain things and I don't have to just survive them, but I can change my relationship to my story and let it empower me and hopefully help empower others.
You know, professionals that I've talked with in the field of domestic violence, domestic abuse, say that it's really important to make a distinction between survivor and victim. And you come across to me through this book as very much a survivor. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and thank you for saying that. I'm not sure that I would have thought that about myself 10 years ago. I think I definitely felt more like a victim at that time. And that was reflected in the choices that I made and the people that I chose to have in my life, still beyond what I've written in this story.
That same review that I read from earlier, the Kirkus Review, it commends you for your courage and determination to change your life circumstances. Where do you think that courage and that determination and the willingness to change, which is really hard for people, where'd that come from, Bobby?
I've always been a seeker, someone who loves to learn, wants to understand things. I enjoy synthesizing information and analyzing information. So I think having that thirst for knowledge and for wisdom was really helpful. But I recall a specific moment when I was 29, 30 years old. I was thinking about all of the relationships that I had had that hadn't gone well. And I was angry about some of those relationships. And the thought hit me all of a sudden that I was the common denominator in all of those relationships. I was trying to figure out, how can I ensure that I never find myself in a similar relationship again when it seemed to be a pattern? And it was that realization that I was the one predictor that was constant throughout those relationships.
Well, how did that epiphany hit you?
Oh, gosh. It was not fun. It was painful. And I realized at that point, too, that nobody was going to come and make my life better for me, that I couldn't wait any longer, and that whatever I could change had to begin with me, because that's the one thing that I knew I had control of. And so I set out to do that, and it was unpleasant. I do think that beginning a journey of self-awareness can be incredibly painful and unpleasant, but I knew I had to do it. I knew I had to face the truth of my adult life and stop waiting for it to magically just get better.
Well, you went on to earn a degree at Berea, and from there, a master's at EKU in English. Is that correct?
Yes. My degree from Berea was philosophy.
Okay. So education seems to have been a salvation.
Yes. I always loved learning. And from a young age, I realized that getting positive feedback in the classroom was a bit of a lifeline for me. And so I was really blessed to be able to do well in school when, from a socioeconomic perspective, that's not a terribly common thing for people who are going through some of the things that I was going through.
There's so much to this book, and I wish we had a lot more time to be able to go into the complexities of it, because you have a lot woven into the fabric of this book, including your perspective as an Appalachian.
Mm-hmm.
Can we touch on that for just a second? I know there's a passage there where you talk about, for example, the dialect, the Eastern Kentucky dialect, which you don't seem to have now.
Yeah, I think still it's something that comes up when I'm around my birth family.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes even at home, I'll say certain words in a way that my kids note is different than, you know, what they're used to me doing. But I started trying to talk like other people when I went to college. And then when I got my first full-time job after college, I was really afraid that I would be discovered as an imposter and that people would realize that I was just a hick or a hillbilly from the country. And for whatever reason, I was afraid that they would also immediately understand all of the painful things that I had experienced, and they would just dismiss me as a person and dismiss my intelligence and my abilities, my credibility. So I unconsciously worked really hard to make sure that, and in some ways consciously, to make sure that people didn't hear me talking like a hillbilly, or I hate to use that word because I think it's a bit overused at this point, but I didn't want people to know where I was from, and I thought I could hide it by doing that.
Well, I think a lot of Eastern Kentuckians, especially those who have gone out into the world and experienced that kind of perception of them, that's going to resonate with them. It does with me. There's a playlist that goes along with your book, and it includes the music of Carla Gover, who just moments ago debuted her new Kentucky Songcrafters series on Eastern Standard. Tell us about that. How does Carla figure into this?
Well, as I'm sure you know, Carla is an incredible musician, and I think she has done some amazing work bringing the old-time music to a modern audience. She also has traveled internationally and represented Kentucky and Eastern Kentucky, I'm sure, just exceptionally well. So I see Carla as a bit of an ambassador for Eastern Kentucky and our culture. The playlist that I put together for my book, I knew immediately that I wanted to include one of Carla's songs called Wings of a Dove that's on their latest album. It is just this lovely story of someone coming to understand their own empowerment and being able to claim agency in their own life, realizing that they're not trapped, that they're not powerless to determine their own fate. And the first time I heard her sing it, I just was moved to tears because it so well represents how I feel about my life. And I'm sure a lot of people will be able to relate to it.
One last question about your book, Bobby. Do you emerge from the experience of writing this book with a message to others who have gone through the kind of abuse that you experienced?
Yes, I think the message could be best summed up by saying that we collectively need to experience more empathy and to have more compassion, both for ourselves and for each other. And I think that beginning with oneself can sometimes be the most important step to overcoming the feeling of victimhood and helplessness in one's own life. For me, learning to love myself while working on myself was really important. And sometimes I had to step out of myself to be able to see myself objectively and see how my history and my present are interconnected. And so, you know, it's hard work to change, and it requires a lot of resolve. But I think that if we can just truly broaden our sense of compassion to even include ourselves, that's a great first step and an important first step.
Bobby Kahn, author of In the Shadow of the Valley, her debut memoir, which is scheduled for release by Amazon Publishing on May 1st. Thank you so much, Bobby.
Thank you, Tom.
This is how the story begins, with all the things that I've been through. Guess I'll have to try and pretend that I'm okay, till I don't have to. And I see miles and miles of blue green hills to climb. And I know nothing's gonna hold me back this time, 'cause I've never felt so free. Feel the changes washing over me, and I never felt such love. It's just like flying on the wings of a
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we'd like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.